book or a nonfiction book. If you pledge $80, you can get one of each or two of whatever category you'd like. We had a couple people making $120 pledges over the last hour, and they get three books. So you choose what level you can support the station at, and we will send you as many books as we possibly can because we just have so many of these books. They are grade A, top quality Focus 580 books that we get from publishers, hardcover, new editions, and we'll send you them. The number to call, it's not toll-free, but if you want to call collect, you can call collect as well. 217-244-9455.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll check back later. And we just want people to keep calling. In the past, when we've done this, we've gotten, I don't know, Jack, you know what the sort of the average number of calls we've done when we've done this has been? Maybe around 20?
I think actually we've done typically better than 20. I think we've had about 8 so far this morning. So we're kind of like halfway to that 20 point. We'd like to really kick it up a notch. I think the record was like 37 books in any two-hour period of Focus 580. So we can beat that easily. We've got hundreds of books, folks, so don't worry that we'll run out.
All right. Well, we welcome to the program in this part of the show Kelly Strom from the Champaign Public Library. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for asking me.
You're the collection manager?
Yes.
What exactly does that mean?
I purchase and oversee all the collections in the adult circulating area of the library. So the adult fiction, the adult nonfiction, Spanish, teen, large print, the magazines, and the audiobooks, and rock pop CDs.
All right. So that's all. So you know, wow. you've got a hand on every new thing that comes in there other than children's books.
Right.
Okay. How many, on a given month, I don't know, how many new things come in?
Gosh, I was afraid you were going to ask
me. just guess.
let's see. I order about somewhere between 120 and 150 a week.
Wow. Okay. So that's an ever-growing. No wonder you need new new space.
That's right.
We were talking in the first part of the show with someone from the Urbana Library, and they now for a while have been engaged in building a new addition for their building. Same thing. And I think that it's true that both of the libraries here in Champaign-Urbana have some of the highest demand of any libraries anywhere.
Yeah. We are two very, very busy libraries, not only in the state, but in the country compared to our per capita and the circulation per capita.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm very glad to have you here. We appreciate it. And Philip Graham
is
hanging around here
just
again
hanging around
from the first hour. And this is a show that we every once in a while do here just to bring guests into the studio and to offer suggestions for people who are hungry for books.
Ooh.
And they both, Philip and, as you hear, Kelly, spend a lot of time just looking at new things and reading themselves, and that's the idea. They have things that they can recommend. Well, why don't we start? I'll start with Kelly. Can you pick up? I know here on the table you have probably about, I don't know, a dozen books.
I brought a lot because I wasn't sure about how many I should have, and I thought the more the better. There is one I think I will start with because I took this at home to read because I heard that it was really good. It's called Call of the Mall. It's a nonfiction book by Paco Underhill. He also wrote the bestseller Why We Buy. He calls himself like a buying archaeologist, or and he does studies on why people buy things, how they behave in a mall, how they he has his own company, EnviroCell, which does research on how people behave when they go in stores, what makes them happy, what makes them want to buy, what turns them off.
He's very famous for doing this. He's the guy that if you want to move a lot of stuff in your store,
you
have him to come.
This is fascinating. Yeah. I don't know if you've read this particular one, and I actually hadn't read Why We Buy. I had heard of it, but I hadn't read it, and I picked this up. I am just giggling while I'm reading and thinking, oh my gosh, that's right. They do that. You know, they do that at our mall. Or I've seen other people do that. And the thing is, you can use that knowledge for any activity. Like we could use some of the things that they do in the mall or some of the things that he recommends at the library. So it's really informative. I actually kept some pages here to talk about
if you'd
like.
A little bit if you'd like.
All
sure.
Right. Here's one part I thought was really interesting. He says, not long ago, I toured a new prototype store for Lowe's, the home improvement chain, with maybe 10 members of the senior marketing team. At some point, I asked to see the ladies' room, which caused a certain amount of unease among my all-male companions, but we found a woman to enter first to check and see if the coast was clear, and in we went. The first shock came when a quick poll of the group revealed that not one of these men had ever been in a ladies' room, despite their high position and years of service at a company that depends on female customer satisfaction practically above all else. The second revelation was that the bathroom, while clean and odorless, was also the most generic, no-frills facility imaginable. Kind of weird, I pointed out, in a store that tries hard to convince people to buy modern, luxurious bathrooms. Which I thought was pretty cool. Yeah. And so he recommends that Lowe's use that opportunity to put some of their high-end things they're trying to sell in the public restrooms so that when people go in there and use it, they're, oh, you know, that is pretty cool. So I thought that was pretty neat. And then there's another one where he talks about, how stores want your hands to be free. Because if they give you a basket or if they ask you to drop off your backpacks and bags at the door, which some will do, like a coat check, then you will buy more if your hands are free to touch things, to manipulate them, that you're more inclined to buy their products.
Sneaky.
I know. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. He spent a lot of time watching people, how they behave in stores, how they move through them, and has all sorts of interesting things about everything about how the store is laid out, how merchandise is displayed. Yeah. I'm sure they think about all the aspects of the store environment that we just sort of washes over us, but it has a lot to do with, you know, are you jazzed about buying stuff? Are you going to come out with something or not?
It's actually fascinating. I mean, I don't know how this sounds to the listener, but the book is absolutely fascinating. And I think part of the point is that when you go in a store that maybe you don't notice those things, you know, they don't want you to notice necessarily that they're trying hard to grab you. They want it to be almost subconscious.
Sneaky again.
I know.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, so the book is titled Call of the Mall.
Yes.
Paco Underhill is the author. And again, this if folks are interested in the titles, the authors we've talked about this morning, it's all going to be on our website, WILL.UIUC.EDU. So if you have internet access, you can go there. Otherwise, we can always, you know, you give us a call, drop us an email, drop us a line, whatever. You know, we can get the information to you. Well, I know.
Well, I want to ask a question about that book. Yeah. Did he advise Lowe's that they need far more employees than they do? Because whenever I go to that place, I feel like I'm in the end of Indiana Jones, you know, where the guy is taking the Ark into this big, giant, enormous facility where you could get absolutely lost. I mean, you could walk around those stores for like 10, 15 minutes before you find anybody who could answer a question.
Yeah. So and I, you know I avoid where Spielberg them for that stole that. You have seen Citizen Kane, haven't you?
Yeah, a long time ago I have. Yeah.
Okay, so.
But I thought I'd do the more contemporary reference. Anyway.
A little later today, a buddy of yours is going to be here talking with Celeste Quinn.
And surprise, surprise, I'm going to recommend this book. Had a good time. Stories from American Postcards by Robin Olin Butler. I should also mention, again, I mentioned being the fiction editor for Ninth Letter, our literary arts magazine on campus. And one of the stories from this book has been published in Ninth Letter in our first issue. We published also the postcard, because every one of these is accompanied, every one of these stories is accompanied by a postcard from the turn of the century. Now, Bob is a great collector, and he collects a lot of things. And one of the things he does collect is postcards. And he collects them not only for the picture on the front, but he mainly, I think, collects them for the little elusive story that he may find on the back. Because when you collect postcards, you're collecting used postcards. And in fact, there are postcard dealers and there are postcard conventions that you could go to. And Bob once had me down to give a reading when he was teaching in Louisiana, right near the Texas border. And after the reading, a day or so after, we drove together to Houston, where there was a postcard convention. And I went with him and watched him collecting his postcards, and I really got into it. In fact, this is kind of amazing. I found a postcard at this postcard convention in Houston that had been written by my mother-in-law to a friend when she was taking a vacation in the Poconos. Completely, completely astounded me. And of course, I bought that postcard.
You know, he's a writer.
That's true. I have the postcard. It's her handwriting. It's true. Anyway, this is actually another plug for our magazine. This is the story Hotel Terrain that we did publish in our magazine. And it starts out with the postcard, the elusive little postcard story. And then Bob takes it from there. So first I'll read what is on the back of an actual postcard that he collected, which has a picture of Hotel Terrain. In Boston on its cover. On the other side is someone who's writing, "This is where the people who have more money than brains put up. They pay about $100 per month for two rooms furnished when they could afford to have a nice home of their own. I had a job in this hotel last year. Worked there for a week. Saw lots of style, but don't see as the people were any happier. And then here's the story. And again, Bob is a master of the first-person voice. You immediately get a sense of who's telling you his story. My fifth day at the hotel, I pretty near ran down John Stanford Barnhill in the corridor past the second-floor library. I was making time with a pitcher of water to a public room along the way where some other swell was receiving guests, like the whole place was his mansion, and he was doing an at-home in his own parlor. The oriental rugs are thick underfoot all over the terrain, and I was making no sound, and Barnhill bolts out of the library door, and I pull up sharp, tucking the pitcher into me so I'll take the splash instead of him. Which I do, down my bellboy jacket with the brass buttons, and he says, "Whoa, Dobbin," like I'm a spook dray horse. I just keep my mouth shut. No, "Sorry, sir," or "Excuse me, sir," like I know I'm supposed to do. But this guy's about my age, not much into his 20s, and he's in a serge suit with cigars sticking out of his pockets, and he gets my goat in an instant. I'm still figuring out what to think about this job, and I decide right off not to play the lackey to guys like this. This is even before I know who he is exactly, heir to millions by being born the only grandnephew of somebody else who was born to millions and so on. I just take the splash and sashay around him and head on down to where I'm supposed to go. He could yell something after me about my being a rude working-class bumpkin or some such, but he doesn't. I figure it's running through his head, though. Then later that day, I'm going out of the place in my own clothes, my uniform hanging in a wire locker in the changing room, and you'd think he'd never recognize me, but you'd think wrong. I'm going out of the hotel, and he says, "You one of those bare-headed anarchists to boot?" To boot, meaning bomb-throwing anarchist in addition to water-spilling bellboy, and the whole thing had been set off by my going out without a hat, which has always been my way, unlike the vast herds of men in the world. I don't like a thing to bind me around my head. All of which sounds grand and free on my part, I guess. That'd be wrong, too, because in response to his cheek I say, "No, sir," and I keep on going, and I like to bite my tongue off.
Very nice. Very nice. This is a collection of stories, and the title of the book is "Had a Good Time."
Had a Good Time
by Robert Olin Butler.
Stories from American Postcards, and it's people writing 100 years ago about various things, and Bob taking those little elusive moments and expanding them into a larger story. Yeah.
And each one truly was inspired by a real postcard
that he collected.
Yeah. And what it is, not only what's the pictures on the front, and they're all in the book, but
they're
also
in the book.
Whatever it is that person wrote home,
to whomever they were writing. Yes, and when you read, if you do that, you read a postcard, you read, again, there's a story coming from the person, there's a story going to the person that you don't know as the reader. It's like, catching a bit of a conversation in a lobby or in a restaurant or something, where we sometimes hear something that's kind of odd and it catches our attention and we want to know what's the larger context. Well, this is something that he provides.
Yeah, very good. Our guest this morning, Philip Graham. He's professor of English at University of Illinois, director of the Creative Writing Program. That was last hour. Kelly Schramm, collection manager of the Champaign Public Library. I should know what hour I'm in here. It's the guest, too. And they're here just to talk about new books. And if people who are listening, by the way, would like to call in and recommend something, that'd be great. I should apologize. We had a caller the first hour, and I guess we kept them waiting too long, and they went away.
But if
that person wants to call back, or anybody else wants to call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Kelly.
Yes.
Give us something else.
Well, I just wanted to say that the library does have Had a Good Time. I remember ordering that one. And we also subscribe to the Ninth Letter. So people who are interested in
Fabulous.
That can come on into the library and check that out.
Can I just mention, too, that Bob is going to be reading at Pages for All Ages tonight at 7 o'clock.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Very good. So you could actually meet the man.
That's
you could
why
see
he's
him
in town.
And hear him. And I suppose if you really wanted to, you could buy a copy of the book.
Mm-hmm. That's what he's hoping.
All right. Very good. Very good. So, what you want?
So, either of you race fans?
I guess I'm interested in the fact that people are interested in it.
Yeah.
But the idea of sitting and watching guys drive around and around in a circle, I guess I don't quite understand.
Don't get the thrill.
Every six months ago, I see the terrible crash on the news, but that's about the length of it for me. Yeah.
Well, I kind of grew up as being a race fan, and my dad, before I was born, was a race car driver. And when I was a kid, he worked a lot of the racetracks in the Midwest. Road America is a big one up in Wisconsin, Elkhart Lake. There's Blackhawk and Rockford. And I was just used to going to the racetracks. And so when I saw this book, Jackaroots, Tale from the Indy 500, I thought I needed to take a look at that. So I picked that out. It's a slim volume. And basically the whole book is short stories from Jackaroot written by some of the experiences he had broadcasting the Indy 500 for all these years. And I just found it really interesting. There's a lot of names that I was familiar with from watching the Indy 500 or going or just hearing other race fans talk. And it's kind of an inside look about what goes on. You know, those of you who are not too interested or not too familiar with the Indy 500 maybe is not aware of all the background information or the things that go on there. And this gives you a look at that. And I really found that interesting. There's a little bit here. I was always a big, I don't know why, a big Mario Andretti fan. And so up until he retired, you know, I'd always be rooting him on for some reason. I don't know why. And there's a little bit here that talks a little bit about that. He says, during the race, Lloyd Ruby, one of my father's favorites, built a lead of almost an entire lap over Mario Andretti. For Rubes, it was his race to lose. Ruby ducked into the pits for his stop on lap 106. It was a routine pit stop for fuel and tires. All four tires had been replaced and the crew just waited for the tank to fill. The tank continued to fill for what seemed like an eternity. Unfortunately, Ruby wasn't about to wait. He was ready to get back out on the track. The car lurched forward with the hose still attached. We watched as methanol spilled out onto the pit stall as the fuel bladders inside the car ruptured. The spill ended Ruby's dream of victory. The team just helped Ruby from the car, packed up their tools, and left the cursed pit. I know. That's then it says in the next little story, it starts off saying, Mario Andretti was more than happy to claim Ruby's dream. He went on to win his first Indy. So I know my husband, you know, who's kind of new to this whole race thing, marrying into the family, always thinks it's so bizarre the way some of these race car drivers, you know, they plan for the biggest race, you know, of the year. And then their car stalls, you know, before they even get started, or they go to the pits and something catastrophic happens and then they're out of the race. He can never understand that. With the amount of money and time that goes into these cars and all of the workers, that it seems like, you know, it should be something that would work flawlessly. But
thing can happen and that gets me get all over.
You never know. So that's Jackaroots, Tales from the Indy 500.
Okay. We have a caller here. Let's talk with him. Someone listening in, Philo, this morning on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, I would like to ask the lady from the Champaign Library a couple of questions, a little bit off base of what you're talking about. But what is her criteria for determining what book she orders? How does she get a feel for what the readership is looking for? And along that lines, and I'll hang up and listen, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sure that a lot of people have that question.
It's a great question. Mm-hmm.
How do you figure out what you're going to buy?
Well, we have decided that our library is what's called a popular materials library. That is our top priority, whereas, say, the university library would be more interested in academics and education. Our top priority of our three is the popular materials library. So other than the huge amount of library journals that are out there telling you the new books that are published, I also always, always check People Magazine, Us Magazine, Sports Illustrated, Better Homes and Gardens, Parents Magazine. We have an automatic ordering plan for anything that's mentioned on Oprah, Regis and Kelly, Good Morning America, and The Today Show. So I really try to focus on what people are hearing about out there, because by golly, if they're hearing about it, I better have it in the library. Mm-hmm. And if I don't, I'm on it and I rush it right away. But so other than those popular material, popular culture things, then I look to the normal library literature, which lists all the things that come out in a given month, which is a huge amount of material, and just things that I think that the people in our community would be interested in, or even the things that some of the kids at school are working on. Like right now, there's a lot of medieval work going on in the school, so I make sure I have a lot of books on medieval times, things like that.
So partly it's a reading of what is popular based on what's recommended, what's reviewed in popular publications. I'm sure also you try to get some feeling for what's selling. But it's you're trying to figure out, and it sounds like in a way it's almost a guess, but maybe it's an informed guess of what it is people want to read. Because as you say, I'm sure that's true. If something that really takes off and it's really popular, people are going to expect it to be there.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're not going to want to wait very long.
Absolutely. So when they created this position as the collection manager, they needed someone who was really was aware of what was going on in the community or what was going on in the world on the news, you know, who was really in tune to popular culture. Hmm. And I used to always joke that I had my finger on the pulse of this nation. It's popular, I better know about it and have it in the library.
I'm sure that often, though, people do come to the library and said, get this book.
Oh, yeah.
Do you try to do that?
Oh, yes.
You probably can't do that for you anything know, that anybody wants.
Ooh, I would say our success rate is very, very high on that, especially if it's a 2004 book. If it's come out this year, I almost always will purchase it. Hmm. If it's an older book, if I think it has limited interest, then we'll interlibrary loan it from somewhere else. But if it's somewhere I think, ooh, you know, that's a hole, we should definitely have had something along those lines, then I go ahead and order.
Because I would think that one of the questions in your mind would be, this one person standing in front of me wants to read this book.
Mm-hmm.
How many other people want
exactly.
to read this book?
Exactly. So that's why I would definitely make sure that we try to get that.
Okay. Very good. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Others are welcome, too. We hope that you will do something else this morning in addition to listening, maybe getting some ideas on reading, possibly calling in and telling us about a book that you've read. We hope that you will also call and make a pledge. Give some money to this radio station. Help pay for this program and others that you enjoy. We are here because people like you not only tune in, but are willing to help pay the bills. Getting close to half of the money to run the station comes from listeners. And that's why we, a couple of times during the year, in a very direct way, sit in here in front of the microphones and say, look, folks, your money is important. We couldn't do what we do without it. And now is the time for you to give us a call and pledge. If you have already, thank you very much. If not, this is the time to do it. And maybe you could call in and make a pledge at the basic level, which is $40. And if you do that, call 244-9455, pledge $40. We'll send you a book, Jack Brighton.
Absolutely. Won't we? Fiction or nonfiction, that's all you got to say. And plus, you know, how much you'd like to pledge. If you make a pledge of $80, we'll send you two books. If you make a pledge of $400, we'll send you 10. And you can do the math and, you know, calculate the distance between those two points. Decide what's right for you. The phone number, 217-244-9455. We get all these books from the publishers. They send them to us because they want us to interview their authors, and we do a lot of author interviews. But we figure, well, we're wealthy with books. Why not share that with the people who support the station? So that's what we're about this morning. It's called Crazy Dave and Jack's Amazing Book Giveaway. And we like to think that we're crazy. We're really not, I don't think.
Not really.
Only in a middle-aged sense.
Kind of boring, kind of boring guys. But, you know, the question people ask is, Dave, how do you do it? Well, it's volume.
That's
volume,
right.
Volume, volume. That's how we can pass on the savings to you.
How can you make money giving away books? That's just, it's baffling.
Well, first of all, you get them for free.
Yeah. Yes.
And then you charge people for them.
Well,
it's a business model that I think really works.
Okay. But actually, you know, this is the funny thing. We don't charge you to listen to the station. We, you know, hope and expect that you'll give something back. You know, this is a community-supported station. That means a little bit here and there, you know, from listeners goes a long way. The more people who contribute to the station, the healthier the future of the station is. So we're not asking you to do any heavy lifting here unless you really want lots of books. What we're asking is a contribution, annual contribution of $40 at a basic membership level. $75 annual contribution gets you the member card, which also gets you 2-for-1 discounts at lots of restaurants and shops around, well, everywhere in the United States, including many in this area. So, you know, and then on beyond that, you know, $120. There are a number of thank you gifts, but right now we're talking about the books. So if you wanted to contribute $10 a month, $120 annual contribution, you can pick 3 books from the Focus 580 book giveaway. 217-244-9455. Do we have time to check in with Dave Thielen?
Yeah,
I know we're getting some calls out there, Dave. How are we doing?
Oh, we're doing very well now. We are at 18 calls, I believe possibly 19. There's one coming in right now. We were trying to get to 20 by 12 o'clock, and I think we're going to do that. But, you know, I'm not sure people appreciate just how many books you get here. And, I mean, I have seen Mike Sola building himself a fort in the weather office. That's how many books we get here. So please take some of these books off our hands because, again, there's just a lot of books out there. Give us a call right now, 244-9455, just like Gretchen Ryerson of Homer, Ian Rennie of Champaign, Tom Boldry of Charleston, Martha Moore of Champaign, and Jenny Harvey of Urbana. Join them. Get a book, get 3 books, get 10 books. 244-9455.
You know, I'm a technology guy, right? I do the internet development around here, and I think that computers are great and all the multimedia stuff on the web is really pretty amazing. But, you know, somebody really should invent a medium that you could hold in your hand that didn't run out of batteries, that, you know, was always on, that you could take anywhere, that didn't use any electricity, that would give you a high density of information.
I think somebody's already done that.
I think that's what a book is, isn't it? It's an amazing technology. A book, and you think of it that way, you know, the information density, the amount that you can get, amount of information and inspiration and all the other things that fine writing can convey to the human mind. These are all available in books, and we love books. You know, we're in broadcasting and multimedia, but...
And books smell good. Absolutely, they smell wonderful.
I'm really happy that at one point when there was lots and lots of discussion about the impact of computers on reading, and people were saying, "Oh, it means we won't need libraries anymore, and people won't read books anymore." And you know, I think we can conclude that that was all bunk, and that books are not going to go away in 100 years. Well, I hope 100 years from now, people will still be reading books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As we are now.
A book is an object of great intimacy. You know, you really are holding someone else's mind in your hands when you're reading it. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing that can improve upon it, in my humble opinion.
So we're offering the greatest gift in the world right now, free books.
All right.
Your pledge call, 217-244-9455.
Let me introduce again our guest, Philip Graham. He's professor of English. He's also director of the Creative Writing Program, University of Illinois. And Kelly Strom, she's collection manager over at the Champaign Public Library. And we're talking about new books. We have another caller here, so we want to talk with. Let us do that. The caller is in Belgium over by Danville, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, all. Mm-hmm. I have a bit of a question. You say people collect every sort of thing you can imagine. Well, I've run into a bit of a problem in my life. I occasionally buy old machinery. And old machinery, sometimes you need an old manual for it. And if people are willing to collect old postcards, would they be willing to collect old machine manuals someplace so somebody could find one to say, well, that's how you repair this problem I have?
You have to go directly to oldmachinery.com on the internet. I mean, I bet somebody has done it, and I bet there's a place to find it, and maybe the web would be a way to come about it. I don't know.
To fix an old machine, huh?
Yeah.
You know, locally, too, Linda Zimmer runs that column in the News Gazette where people who need things such as that, she puts the call out, and they've gotten surprising results.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I suppose also if there was something like I'm not sure what kind of machinery that you're dealing with, but there may be, a collector's association of that, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, I would think that
there is.
That would be likely if it's, if it's, for example, I don't know, does it have something to do with woodworking or carpentry?
Woodworking.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. See? And I'm sure that
the machines have long since, the company has long since gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe there was never an owner's manual in the first place, but I'm going to look.
But you're right about there. If there's groups out there, people who are similarly interested.
Historical societies,
sure,
all sorts of places.
There could very well, you know, I know, for instance, the library has Encyclopedia of Association. So if you looked up a woodworkers group or even antique woodworking or something like that and then contacted an organization like that, they might be more knowledgeable about where to locate them.
Yeah, that might be a good help. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Let's see.
Great question.
We have someone else to talk with in Indiana. Line number 1. Hello.
Yeah.
Hi.
If that guy's listening, Lindsay, 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 Publications Incorporated. They're on the web, and all this guy does is get a books. They're out of copyright and prints them up, and a lot of them have to do with how to file your files and things like that, and he has stuff on machinery. I came across him because he has a nice little book on chemical cross-reference. It gives the old names for certain chemicals that are were used at one time at the turn of the century, mostly by farmers and by machinists and things like that. Like copper sulfate, we know it was copper sulfate back then. They called it blue vitriol. Mm-hmm. And there's other chemicals that if you look up and it tells you exactly what the chemical name is instead of the, say, the folk name or what have you. If he gives that a run, he might find something. I was on their web one time and looked at it. I noticed some of those kinds of manuals they had for sale dealing with older machinery.
Goodness.
Whether or not they have exactly, you know, steroid or something like that, I don't know. But I do know they had that information.
Well, that's a good suggestion. Very good. Thanks.
Good show.
Thank you.
Man, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back here to our book kind of program. And of course, again, all the way along, if people want to call in and say hi and recommend a book or whatever, they can certainly do that. Now, Philip is sitting. Okay. He has a book in his hand.
I actually have a book that I might want to recommend to Kelly if they don't have it in the library. This is a book I read 20 years ago and loved it. And I had an occasion this semester. I normally teach fiction writing workshops in my job at the university. But I'm teaching a literature course this semester. And I decided, well, this is a book I want to teach. And I did it on the basis of my memory of this book from 20 years ago. And I have to say that my memory of it was actually not really correct in the sense that it's actually 10 times better than I remember it being. In fact, I think it is one of the great novels of the 20th century.
Wow.
And it's a novel called History, a novel by the Italian writer Elsa Morante. And this is a big book. It's about 740-odd pages, and it's about World War II. And, in fact, the way the chapters are organized, it starts out with the years before World War II. So it's 19-hyphen-hyphen, and then 1941 all the way up to 1947 and then beyond. But the key years of 41 to 47 are chapters in which each chapter starts with an italicized section that gives us month by month what happened in a given year. So you get the headlines. You get all the campaigns and the battles and the atrocities and the massacres and everything else. And then the bulk of the chapter after that is the life of one Italian family, the Mancuso family, living in Rome. And we see how the larger events that we all read about in quote-unquote history affect these very, very ordinary people who never get written about. Mm. And this is a writer who has unbelievable empathy. Morante herself was a partisan in the war in Italy during those years. She had to hide for a long time from the Germans who were looking for her. And yet when she writes about the Germans doing the things that they do in this book, she always makes it a point to talk about them as boys, young boys, who don't fit into their uniforms because they're the recruits from the latest sweeping draft in Germany. And that when they're kicking down doors, they're kicking the doors because they're frightened. Because they don't know what they're going to see on the other side. And she never lets anybody lose their humanity. And it's really quite an extraordinary book. She also writes beautifully about animals, birds, dogs, cats. She'll give the history of a dog that someone adopts, you know, that the characters can't themselves know, but she does. She has a wide-ranging kind of omniscient narrative voice. And she does things that I've just never seen some writers do that just astound me. One of the things that she does is a wonderful section where we get to see this one family that Ida Mancuso and her young son, Giuseppe, they're staying because they're very poor and there's been a famine in Rome and so forth. They're staying in the apartment of another family, the Moroccos, and they're waiting for their son, Giovannino, to come back from the Russian front. Now, if you've been reading the italicized sections carefully, you know that he's probably dead because most of the people who went to the Russian front with the Germans and the Italians didn't come back. But this family believes and believes and believes that he's coming back, and they have, you know, card readers who come and so on and so forth. And the room that Ida and Giuseppe are staying in is Giovanni's room, and she describes in great detail what this room looks like, all the objects. So we get to know Giovanni even though we never see him. And then finally, after 70 or 80 pages, we finally get the story of Giovanni, his death. And it's a story that Morante tells to the reader. She doesn't have it being given to the family. In fact, the family never knows what happens to him. Mm-hmm. But we find out about it. And, of course, he's struggling, crawling through the snow. He's slowly dying from the cold. And while he's slowly dying from the cold on this retreat that's become a massacre, he starts to hallucinate that he's back home. and he imagines that he's back home. And this is the last few moments of Giovanni's life. Giovannino doesn't know what's coming over him. Now he doesn't feel like doing anything but sleep. The open, sunny light lasts another instant, and immediately afterward, also here at Santa Canta, it has become dark, because again, he believes that he's not where he is. There is a cool, restful little evening breeze which comes and goes with a fan's slight movement. And before sleeping, Giovannino would like to curl up, as he always has enjoyed doing, except that his body, because of all the cold, has become so stiff he can't bend anymore. But at the same time, Giovannino realizes, as if it were a natural thing, that he also has a second body, which, unlike the first, is supple, clean, and naked. And, content, he crouches into his favorite position for lying in bed, with his knees almost touching his brow, huddled until a comfortable hole is hollowed out in his mattress beneath him. And as he nestles there, the dry leaves inside the mattress make a rustle, as if the wind were blowing them, summer and winter. This is the position he has always assumed to sleep, as a baby, as a little boy, and as a grown man. However, every night, at the moment he curls up in this way, he feels he has become tiny again. And indeed, little, big, grown up, young, elderly, old. In the dark, we are all the same. Good night, Giovannino.
Wow.
I have been teaching this book in the past month, and in two classes, I and the rest of the class has almost burst into tears at times because this is such a moving and beautiful book. It's one of the most remarkable books in that she has empathy for everyone and everything. She sees every side of it. I'll just go one little last thing if I can find it. Just talking about it while I'm looking is there's this one point, and she goes on after the war too, and after the war there's a terrible, terrible murder of a prostitute by her pimp, and we get all the things that, you know, that are terrible about that. We see the site of the murder. We see the person who has killed this woman, who we've seen before, we see him give himself up, and that's like the outer way of looking at it. You know, we go horrible, terrible, so on and so forth, and then she gives us the history of the guy. Who Nello D'Angeli, the history of the guy who kills Santina, the prostitute. And we find out that what his life was like and how horrible it was, and that he's come up. She says everybody has an explanation of how the world works. And Nello D'Angeli had an explanation for how the world worked. It was that everybody in the world is an enemy of Nello D'Angeli. And his relationship with Santina unnerves him because he's finding himself falling in love with her. And he doesn't know how to love or be loved, and it becomes a stain that gets him so angry at times that, in fact, he kills her because he loves her. And then, you know, she writes this, and it's not to make you feel, oh, now I understand that. Now I understand why this happened, and it kind of, you know, it justifies her. No, never is anything justified. All the horrible things that happen in this book, because this is a book about horrors, because it's a book about the horrible World War II. It's not that anything is justified, but that she refuses to let the reader say, bad, you know. She says you have to understand what's going on. So again, when the Germans do what they do, she always presents them as human beings. And when they're being killed by the partisans, we hear them crying, Mutter, Mutter, and so forth. We understand they have their own lives. She sees all the victimizers in this book as victims themselves. It is a remarkable book. I think it's one of the great books of the 20th century.
Yeah, okay, and tell us again that
Elsa Morante, History, a Novel.
All right, very good. Well, let's go on. Well, I'll turn again over here to Kelly.
Well, on that note, I kind of feel silly going on to the next one. That was so riveting. You know, on TV, the big popular thing now is the CSI stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got CSI, Miami, CSI, God only knows, what is it, Las Vegas?
I mean, I'm a Law and Order partisan myself, but...
Yeah, there's a lot of choices out there for those forensic fans. And so there is a forensic criminologist, Dr. Henry C. Lee, who has written books before about his field. And there's a new one out that he's written called Cracking More Cases, The Forensic Science of Solving Crimes. And once again, that's by Dr. Henry C. Lee. And he is considered by many to be actually the greatest forensic criminologist in the world. He worked on the O.J. Simpson case, the Skakel-Moxley case, the JonBenet Ramsey, and more. And the book is pretty interesting in that it goes into such detail about what happened during the crime, as far as they know, the timeline. How did the prosecutors or the investigators handle the situation? Perhaps what mistakes might have been made, and what can you infer from that? And I don't have anything to read from the book, but I did think it was pretty interesting for those people who out there who are really into that sort of thing. Patricia Cornwell, you know, writes a lot of fiction about medical examiner, and I think there's just a lot of interest right now in that field.
Well, there certainly is. I mean, if we see how many popular stories, television, movies, in other words, it really has to do with that thing, unraveling crimes by using science. Obviously, there's a great appeal for those kind of stories. Sure. And this is the real deal.
This is the real deal.
This is the real deal.
You know, it's a fascinating field. I do have to warn you, as I was skimming through, I did see that there were some pictures in that are perhaps a little gruesome.
Oh, thanks for the warning.
People may not, want to view. But and there's other people out there who write about this field, but he is one of the top names, and it's brand new.
Okay, very good. Well,
why don't you go again? They took a lot of time on there, aren't they?
No.
Well, yeah, because you're only here for the 1 hour.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And Philip's been here for since
days.
Resilient years.
Days.
Been here for days.
Well, I just love listening to you talk. I think you should record audiobooks. You have a lovely voice to listen to.
Have you done your own books?
Other people have done my books, but
really?
Not me.
Oh,
yeah.
You should.
Okay. Yeah.
You have a wonderful voice.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Another brand new one that's out is called Why I Wore Lipstick to My Mastectomy. And it's written by Geralyn Lucas. And it's a woman who was diagnosed with breast cancer at 27 years old. And basically, it's also a slim volume. And basically, the whole book is about her getting used to the idea that she has this in her life, you know, what this means for her, what this means about her self-image, about she's married, so what her husband thinks of this. And it goes by every step that she takes in the diagnosis and the treatment and what comes and the decision she needs to make and the decisions the doctors help her to make. And I just found it really useful as far as learning more about breast cancer for people who happen to be in that predicament or have friends or family who are.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that to be a really interesting book, and it is brand new. Just came in, I think, last week, and it's gotten a lot of press.
Yeah. Must be that as you look at certain categories that people are interested in, it must be books about health.
Oh yeah,
must
and
be
politics.
One of the biggest things.
Yeah. About
what they have to do with each other as separate categories.
Health, politics, and then a lot of like home improvement, gardening type of things are probably our biggest areas at the library.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was a big one. You want to talk about another one, Phil?
Okay. I don't know.
Which one?
So many. Is this horrible way? Okay, I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do this. Okay, this is another book from Nebraska, by the way, and I discovered this because when I found out that Nebraska had this European women writers series, I found out they also have a Latina women's writers series, and they have a experimental European fiction writing series. They do wonderful stuff, and this is a novel called Minor Angels by a French writer named Antoine Volodin. And it's about, I'm not a depressed person. This is about the extinction of the human race. and so this is a story that's set in the future, and these pieces read like dreams in which there are just not very many people left. And everything is being recycled. So you go to a market, and at the market there are indigent secondhand merchants plying their trades. There in the butcher's section, for instance, scraps of fatty meat and tripe scrapings and ham rinds were introduced into the commercial circuit. In the area reserved for recovered hardware, the vendors offered half nails, crumbling hinges, iron filings, or fragments of rust collected in the bottom of a can. And it's this story about a man, Will Schneidman, who has actually been brought into life by a number of 300 or 400 or 500-year-old women who just won't die, who had started what is a kind of like a Pol Pot revolution, and they've destroyed the world against capitalism. There's nothing left. And then they hear that capitalism is starting to come up again, and they're too old to fight it. So they collect rags and buttons and things like that, and they make a person because they're too old to have a baby. And they make a person named Will Schneidman, and they make him into life. So this is also very dreamlike and so forth. And he goes out, and he actually decides that he wants to help people, you know, because everybody's been devastated. There have been prison camps and mass graves and everything else because of what his grandmothers have done. And so he starts to help out the people who are trying to come back again. And then he's captured by his grandmothers, and they have him ready to be shot. And they keep shooting at him. They keep missing because he's telling them these stories of all the people he's met while he's been there. And every chapter is a short chapter, a story of another person that he's met in his journey of the disastrous, destroyed world that he's seeing. And there's a wonderful thing that's said here, and this is what made me want to buy the book. It says here, from Antoine Volodine comes a deeply disturbing and darkly hilarious novel whose full meaning, its author asserts, will not be found in the book's pages, but in the dreams people will have after reading it. And I have to admit that I've had two dreams about this book while reading it. And so, you know, the jacket copy works, folks. You know, you'd never think so. And it's a beautiful, mysterious book that isn't quite definable, and yet the writing is so beautiful and so exact that you keep reading and you keep loving these strange characters. They keep reappearing in other people's stories, too, so you really get the web of this world. Yeah. It's a remarkable book.
I like that. It's a great recommendation for a book. I think that, and I've had that experience, maybe other people have. Sometimes you have experience with a really good film, that afterwards you cannot stop thinking about
that's
it.
Right.
It will
that's
not
it.
Let go of you for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think that's a mark of a good story.
Yeah. Minor Angels by Antoine Volodine.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to say that we're pretty much done with this hour.
Man.
And I know we've just got started. But we do these shows frequently, and I would be very happy to, if Kelly, you would come back and we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, I still have tons more here.
Yes.
Well,
that's the thing about books, you know?
That's the thing. I don't think that we have ever, and
never.
When Philip has been here and Tanya has been here, and the same thing was true this morning, we never get through all of the ones that they bring because we get so excited about particular ones, you know. And you want to give people the taste of it without giving too much. Philip is always
very nervous about that.
Very
scared.
I'm nervous about that. So I want to thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Kelly Strom, Collection Manager at the Champaign Public Library. And as I said at the end of the first hour, if you have questions about books, if you're looking for something in particular, if you're just looking for a recommendation of a book within a particular category, go to the library and go to the folks there. Don't be shy.
That's our job.
That's their job. They love it. You know, you won't be bothering them. You know, you'll have to speak very quietly.
No.
Oh, you don't have to do that anymore. Okay.
Not a Champaign.
You can speak in a normal tone of voice. You don't have to whisper. And they will be very happy to help you out. So thanks very much.
Sure.
Thank
you.
And Philip, of course.
It's always great to have you here.
Yeah, as always. And we'll have the books on the website, will.uiuc.edu, if you have internet access. And if you don't, we can get you the information some other way, too. Speaking of the website, the guy who really makes that happen is Jack Brighton. He's here in the studio with me.
Hello.
And also has for a long time been involved with this program, was producer, continues occasionally to fill in as host, was good enough when I was on vacation for the entire 2.5 weeks, I think, to be the host for the program. And that's a lot to take on when you actually have other things to do, too. So I really appreciate it. And everybody said, God, that guy Jackie did a really good job.
Yeah, I love doing the show. It's a great show. And it's tough to fill in for David, but, we do what we can. And right now, what we have to do is give out that phone number so that we can give away more books. That's what we're doing this couple hours on Focus. 217-244-9455. Get in on Crazy Dave and Jack's amazing book giveaways. I love saying that. If you call with a $40 pledge, we will give you a book. Brand new hardcover, 2004, published, really high quality stuff. Fiction or nonfiction, your choice. You can just tell the phone volunteer. We've had a bunch of calls, and I see that we're not getting any at the moment. So if you call right now, you'll get first in line for the big Focus 580 book giveaway. 9455. And folks, when we ask you to join the Friends of WILL, what exactly are we asking? Do you have to join some kind of group meeting that you have to show up to every month? No, it does not involve any committee work whatsoever. It just simply involves a small financial contribution on your part. Think of it as a subscription. You know, if you pay for a magazine or something like that, or a newspaper, or your cable bill is more than really what we're asking for to get a free book. So 217-244-9455. This station depends on the support of its listeners. And so we hope you make that call.
Yeah.
Let's check in with Dave Teal.
Yeah, let's do it.
How are we doing on the number of books given away so far, Dave?
Well, we've heard from at least 22 listeners this morning. I believe we may have, in fact, nope, 23. There's a call coming in right now. We've heard from Tana Blackwell of Mattoon, J.N. Plum of Normal, and Dale Henkel of Princeton. They've all called in, taken advantage of the book offer this morning, and somebody else is doing that right now. So this is your last opportunity of the morning to do that, well, of this drive, as a matter of fact, this pledge drive.
That's right.
To get in on the book offer, so 244-9455. We got a lot of books. I've seen them.
That's right. And I've mentioned a couple times that if you pledge at $80, then you can get two books. I mean, it's just a matter of simple math, right? Right, Dave?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, you meant the other
we're
Dave.
Both Dave.
Well, yeah, okay.
It's confusing.
Right. Simple math is all we're capable of, really. But a couple people donated $120, and they're going to get three books, and we're happy. Just, you know, if you want two fiction, one nonfiction, we have lots of books. Believe me, the publisher sent them to us hoping we'll interview the authors. So we'd like to pass that on to you. So we'll share the wealth. And 217-244-9455, that's how you can do it.
All right. Thank you both very much, Jack and Dave. Before we go, we'd like to thank some other people who support the station. Our show is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium at 203 North Vine in Urbana, offering a selection of domestic and international beers and spirits, also wine tastings. The Corkscrew, 337-7704, and on the web at thecorkscrew.com. And indeed, we hope that you will join with them in supporting the station. You can get yourself a book and come away with the good feeling that comes with knowing that you're helping to pay the bills and keep alive and strong this service that you enjoy. 244-9455, that is the number. Tomorrow morning, just a reminder, Dr. Bob Bocek will be here for our monthly show on children's health. Also, a special visit with Doyle Moore, the man we'd like to call our chef in residence. We'll have a little special recipe collection to offer as well, and we're going to be talking about chili. So that's tomorrow, so I hope you can tune in. Of course, right now, we hope you stay tuned, because up next is the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. And coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with writer Robert Olin Butler. His latest book is a collection of short stories inspired by the picture Postcard. The title, Had a Good Time, Stories from American Postcards. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. December wheat, 3.15 and a quarter, down 4. March, 3.26, that down 3 and 3 quarters. December corn, 2.07, unchanged. March, 2.16 and 3 quarters, down 1 quarter. May, 2.24 and a quarter, up 1 quarter. December corn, 2.46, up 3 quarters. November beans, 5.31, up 3 and a quarter. January, 5.34, up 1 and 3 quarters. March, 5.39, up 1 and a quarter. December meal, 157.40, that up 60. December oil, 20.73, that up 6 cents. October feeder cattle, 112.30, down 1.10. October live cattle, 86.55, down 1.30. December lean hogs, 66.35, that down 15, and February bellies, 93.50, down 102 and a half.